Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support of our locally owned bookstore. We very much appreciate you being here tonight. Thank you. Andrew Bacevich is a retired colonel and a Vietnam veteran who spent 23 years in the U.S. Army. He is now a professor of history and international relations at Boston University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Andrew's previous books include The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, and The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, which received the inaugural Lannan Literary Award for an especially notable book in 2005. He joins us tonight to discuss and sign his latest book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Please join me in welcoming Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thanks very much for and the invitation to speak at this wonderful independent bookstore, and thanks so much for turning out. I am in, I think it's day 16 of my book tour. We have Minneapolis, Chicago to go, and then home to Boston. I can report to you on day 16 that book touring is a privilege and a trial and an education. And I seriously mean all three of those. It's a privilege to be able to speak with you, and because I'm going to speak relatively briefly, to let you speak at me so we can have some discussion. Even though I've done this now more times than I can count, it's a genuinely energizing experience to participate in these kinds of events, and I am very conscious of the fact how lucky I am to be able to do it. But book touring is a trial. At some point, all the airports look the same, and I have to say that all the hotels look the same. And the restaurants may be different, but sometimes it's difficult to discern the differences. And it's an education. This is the second time in my tour I've decided to wear a tie. And I did that because I pack lightly, and basically I've been wearing the same blazer every day now since I departed for New York and this thing started. It has been cleaned once. Ducked in a radio station, dumped it in a cleaner, and then got it back when we came out of the radio station. And the education comes from the fact that the first time I put my tie on, I did it in Berkeley. And that's exactly right. Everybody laughed at me. It was a wonderful occasion and a wonderful event, but I felt like a total sap. And I said to myself, well, of course, you're in Berkeley. What are you wearing a tie for? Now you have laughed at me. So here's what I propose that we do, and that is that I'll make relatively brief remarks. I don't think that the talk goes for more than 15 minutes or so, and then that'll give us a pretty good amount of time so we can have questions and discussion. And I think we're supposed to adjourn the formal part at around 8:30, and if I have done my job, you will rise up as one person and assault me at the book signing table, each of you bearing under your arm multiple copies of the book, demanding that they be signed for your children, your grandchildren, your godchildren, and probably the guy who picks up the trash on Friday morning, who you know really should read Washington Rules. So let me begin. Why are we? This is a question that's just everybody's talking about. Why are we in Afghanistan? Why were we 40 years ago in Vietnam? Two questions. One answer, I think. We are in Afghanistan, we were in Vietnam, because Washington stubbornly adheres to a national security consensus, a basic approach to national security policy, that I believe consists of two identifiable, specific elements. The first of those elements, I style in the book The American Credo, defines purpose. The second of those elements, styled in the book The Sacred Trinity, defines practice. The Credo summons the United States, and we need to emphasize the United States alone, to lead, save, liberate, and transform the world. According to the Sacred Trinity, in order to accomplish this large, ambitious purpose, the United States, and again, the United States alone, in terms of thinking about military power, is called upon to maintain, first, a global military presence. Second, to configure its forces, not with the idea of defending the country, but rather to create instruments of global power production. And third, marrying this global military presence with these global power projection capabilities, that the United States counters existing or anticipated threats by relying on a policy of global interventionism. Together, Credo and Trinity constitute the essence of the way that Washington has attempted to govern and to police what has commonly been called the American century. The Trinity lends plausibility to the Credo's vast claims. The Credo justifies the Trinity's vast requirements and vast exertions. Together, they define the rules to which Washington adheres, and they determine the precepts by which Washington attempts to rule. But there's a problem. And the problem is that the Washington rules don't work. At least they don't work any longer. Indeed, in my judgment, blind adherence to the Washington rules is proving to be counterproductive, something that the events since 9/11 ought to have made manifestly apparent. Promising safety and security, the Washington rules have delivered us into a circumstance which is really akin to permanent war. I mean, we live in a country where war has now become a normal condition. To be at war is uncontroversial. Promising to preserve the American way of life, the Washington rules have set the United States on a course toward bankruptcy. Bankruptcy in a fiscal sense, but I think also bankruptcy in a moral sense. So what should replace the existing Washington rules? Well, I offer some thoughts in the book. I think that to replace the existing American credo, there ought to be a new credo. And the basis of the new credo should recognize that America's true purpose and its primary obligation is to be America, fulfilling the aspirations expressed in our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. Not least among those aspirations, The clause that concludes the preamble of the Constitution states that the purpose of our union is to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for our posterity. And I think if there's a word that deserves emphasis there, it's posterity. Not only does it seem to me that we have a great deal of work to do to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves, that is to say, for the present generation, but it seems to me that the way we're handling our affairs, what we're really doing is prejudicing, reducing the likelihood that our posterity is going to have an equal opportunity to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And indeed, it seems quite possible to me that future generations will curse us for denying them the legacy to which they are owed. Now, if there is somebody out there who says, aha, we have smoked him out. He is obviously an isolationist. All he wants to do is to turn our backs on the world and pull up the drawbridges and ignore everybody else. That's not really the case. I would argue, however, that to the extent that the United States does have some sort of larger mission that relates to people and nations outside our borders, that perhaps the best way for us to accomplish our mission is not by attempting to force down the throats of others our understanding of what freedom means, but rather to serve as an exemplar for others, to demonstrate through our own adherence to liberal values the possibility that living consistent with liberal norms and values may have some value to others, something from which they may learn. But even that, I would say, if indeed serving as an exemplar is a way to accomplish this mission to the outside world, I would insist that we not confuse this side benefit for our primary purpose. And our primary purpose relates to the obligation that governments have to their people. I think that when it comes to thinking about military policy, we also need to have a new trinity to replace the existing sacred trinity. My own sense of what that trinity might look like would include the following. First, that we should define the primary duty station of the American soldier as being in America. Primary duty station. I would acknowledge that there will be times, there will be purposes that will entail us sending American soldiers to some far-off country that needs to be defended or liberated or fought over. But I would want to insist that those ought to be relatively rare occasions. And the practice into which we have fallen for the past several decades, which assumes that we are called upon to outpost the planet on a permanent basis, seems to me to be both absurd and counterproductive. The second element of my trinity would be one that would say that rather than configuring our forces in order to provide instruments of global power projection, let's configure our forces with an eye toward defending the United States and its most vital interests. Now, to stick in that little hook at the end, vital interests can be a problematic thing. Because that is a phrase that is tremendously elastic and is subject to abuse. I mean, I'm sure we can pick up tomorrow's newspaper, if there are any newspapers left tomorrow, and probably find somebody arguing that Yemen or Somalia or God knows where is a vital interest of the United States. We understand the extent to which that can open the door to ill-advised policies. But I would still argue that in a democratic polity, issues like defining vital interests are appropriate subjects for debate, and that out of democratic politics can come some reasonable sustainable, and realistic understanding of what actually do constitute vital interests, what do constitute the issues beyond our borders that are of sufficient importance that we ought to fight for them. But to have any meaning at all, that list of vital interests has to be a relatively short one. And finally, with regard to the use of force, my Trinity would urge that we adhere to the norms described in the just war tradition. Now, the just war tradition evolved over a period of century, for the most part, by Christian theologians, attempted to provide a series of guidelines to help us evaluate whether or not a particular war or conflict could be viewed as moral or not. I have to say I've long since come to believe that the just war tradition is not useful simply in order to answer moral questions. It also provides useful guidelines to answer far more pragmatic or policy-oriented questions. And in that regard, it seems to me when it comes to the use of force, we should employ force as the just war tradition dictates, only as a last resort, and only in self-defense. And even then, we should recognize the limited utility of violence as an instrument of statecraft. And we should enter into any conflict with a lively appreciation of the probability of unexpected second-order consequences and of costs that are likely to be far greater than anybody anticipated in the first place. Because that is the reality of military history across the ages. Well, how likely is it that we will see any departure from the Washington rules, any embrace of an alternative credo or an alternative trinity, as I have suggested to you? Well, I'm sorry to say, I think it's quite unlikely. Why is that? Well, two reasons. And the first reason is that even if the Washington rules, as I have described them, are not making us safer and more prosperous, are not protecting our liberties, may indeed be undermining our liberties. The sad fact is that the Washington rules do work for Washington. And Washington is deeply invested in maintaining the national security status quo. Why is that? Because the status quo, because the Washington rules deliver enormous profits to the military-industrial complex, because those profits, not those profits exclusively, are of enormous use to politicians who are committed to raising money in sufficient quantities that they'll be able to win re-election. The Washington rules enable the institutions comprising the national security state, whether we're talking about the Pentagon or the CIA, enables them to justify the prerogatives that they have come to exercise and to justify the budgets that they have come to see as their entitlement. The Washington rules enable ambitious military officers and ambitious civilian officials to fancy that they are participating, that they are at the center of history in undertaking grand and glorious enterprises. I think the Washington rules even find a lot of approval in the media, which should know better. I mean, I think you know and I know that there's nobody who gets more excited about the prospect of U.S. forces being sent into action than reporters, for whom war stories are the ultimate stories. So we're not going to see much change if we expect Washington to bring about change, because Washington is committed to the practices to which we have been adhering for several decades. But I think there's a second reason why we're unlikely to see any departure from the Washington rules, and that second reason really lands a lot closer to home. It's us. That we have been too long conditioned and have come to accept the fact that really there exists no alternative to to insisting upon playing this role of global leadership, that there is no alternative to maintaining a global military presence, to configuring our forces for global power projection, and no alternative to the pattern of interventionism that really has come to be such an important expression of what we do in the world beyond our borders. To put it another way, we have lost the ability to really ask first-order questions about national security policy and to admit into our debate the possibility that there are other ways to approach this matter. And I think this tendency to defer to Washington, our tendency to defer to Washington, may in fact pose the greatest obstacle to restoring good sense to U.S. policy. So with that, I'll stop, and I look forward to questions, comments, and at least some small sense of hopefulness that you will be able to offer to counter my deep-seated pessimism. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
If and when the U.S. stands down as the world's policeman, what do you see as a replacement for that? The U.N. or some other form of collective security?
Were the United States to abandon the Washington rules, which really is based on an expectation that if we don't run the show, everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket, what might be an alternative arrangement to ensure an international order? Great question. I think my answer, and this gentleman, no, I thought you were, okay, all right. I think my answer would be an answer that would reflect my own, no doubt, limited ability to peer into a crystal ball and anticipate what will be the most important factors determining the international order in the 21st century. And speaking off the top of my head, I think the two things that I would cite that would be likely to be exceedingly important, number one is going to be that we are moving away from an order that since 1945 has either been dominated by two great powers or has been dominated by one great power. I think we're probably moving toward an order in which there are going to be a number of powers whose interests will have to be taken into serious consideration, and an order in which we'll have a modicum of peace, or to put it another way, we'll be able to avoid catastrophic war if we can create some kind of a condominium of power. Who would be the major participants in this order? Well, us. I mean, despite the fact that I think we are no longer at the zenith of our power, you know, we're not quite down at the level of Paraguay yet. Apologize to any Paraguayans in the audience. So we will continue to be a very important, probably the most important, member of the international order. But there is also Europe. Stable, liberal, despite some current economic issues, rich, currently with an aversion to military power, and therefore not fully willing to play the role in international security affairs that it probably ought to. The fact that it's not willing to do so now doesn't mean it's not going to be willing to do so 20 years or 40 years from now. Certainly Russia is going to be a player in that order. So will India. So will China. Now, there are people, especially when the topic of China comes up, who say, dirty, rotten commies, want to take over the world, looks like another Cold War. That tends not to be my view. It seems to me that although the People's Republic of China is governed by the a communist party, it is a one-party state, that the purposes of the Communist Party and of the People's Republic is not to spread the revolution around the world, it is to get rich. And in that regard, although our interests and their interests are likely to bump into one another from time to time, it doesn't seem to me that their purposes and our purposes are necessarily incompatible, unless, of course, we revert to our insistence that the entire world must conform to the liberal democratic principles that we profess to represent. So I think moving towards that kind of a concert of powers would offer the best way to avoid catastrophic war. The second thing I think that is going to play a tremendous influence is going to be the continued rise of a category of problems to which no single nation state can provide an effective response. And the most, I think, at this point, I would say the greatest of those is likely to be come from the effects of climate change. And that if, I'm not a climate change scientist, I'm not any kind of scientist, but if in the range of projections about what could happen as a consequence of climate change, if the more extreme projections should come to pass, well, the global agenda is going to undergo a rather radical transformation sometime in the next, 40 or 50 years. And it's going to make a lot of the things we currently argue about look pretty darn trivial. You mentioned the United Nations. Almost all Boston University students love the United Nations. Because it just seems like it ought to be such an easy way to fix so many problems. I'm skeptical, and frankly, I think the United Nations serves useful purposes. The purposes it serves fall way short of the hopes and expectations of the people who founded the United Nations back in 1945. I'm skeptical that any amount of tinkering or reform is going to fix the UN or fix what's broken in the UN. Doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to try. Just don't think we should look to the UN to be a world government in any real sense. Yes, ma'am.
I probably can't say this very eloquently, but can you, with your expertise, link the credo and the sacred trinity with 9/11, as far as do you feel that having that type of a Washington rule up to then, our country was then attacked, and many people then said, well, we somehow let down our guard, or, I mean, the new war, the war on terror and the terrorism, is that a direct...
Yeah, how does the U.S. response to 9/11 reflect or fail to reflect the Washington rules, the credo and the trinity? I think the response clearly reflects the matter of fact, the response to 9/11 casts in very sharp relief the importance of the Washington rules as kind of the default position for policymakers. When 9/11 occurred, let us remember who George W. Bush was the day before 9/11. The George W. Bush who came from the state of Texas, who, I'm not trying to be demeaning in any way, who when he ran for the presidency really didn't know much of anything about foreign policy, and frankly, I'm not saying this to be insulting, I'm really not. I think did not really have a fully developed worldview. Remember when he ran for the presidency, and I think, and again, I'm not trying to be unfair. I think for the most part, when it came to foreign policy, he was reciting lines that were handed to him. And they were lines that were written by people who thought they were tuned in to the feelings and concerns of the American people. And one of the lines said, "We don't do nation building. We don't do nation building. Nation building is stupid." And another one of the lines, if you remember this, this is back in the year 2000. Another line said, "If I'm elected president, we're going to have a humble foreign policy." His words, not mine. Humble foreign policy. Again, I think he said those things. I don't mean he was lying, but I think this is what the speechwriters told him to say, and the president said, or the governor said, "Yeah, that sounds about right," and that's what he said. 9/11 happens, and George W. Bush becomes Woodrow Wilson. George W. Bush gets up in the morning and says that it is the purpose of the United States of America not simply to spread democracy, but to eliminate tyranny and evil itself. That's our purpose. And that's what I, George Bush, now intend to lead this great country to accomplish. If that isn't an expression of the American credo, I don't know what is. Then the second piece, the military response. Let us crank back our brains to 9/11 and ask in the most immediate sense, what happened that day? What happened that day? Is it 19 thugs with box cutters were able to enter major American airports and hijack airliners and crash them into buildings? Because local, state, and federal agencies responsible for security totally failed in their obligations. It was as if you went back. Where do you live, ma'am?
Dayton, Ohio.
They come from far and wide. I was in Dayton last year, giving a talk at the university. And it's a wonderful city. Although when National Cash Register left, pew, not good. You do. Members of the military-industrial complex. It is as if you left your front door unlocked and wide open every night. And then lo and behold, here comes some guy who sneaks in and steals the family silver. Well, obviously it's a bad guy and he should be brought to justice, but to some degree, who is responsible for this? And what happens in the wake of this failure adequately to defend ourselves? And as we decide we're going to go invade and occupy countries and change them so that future attacks won't occur. We are going to take our power projection capabilities, at that time thought to be unstoppable, and we are going to race into Afghanistan, we're going to race into Iraq, we're going to overthrow the government, we're going to kill the bad guys, and we're going to sprinkle the fairy dust of liberal democracy and things are going to be fixed. Now, there I was being snide. But that's in essence describes the response to 9/11. So I think in spades, what has happened since 9/11 manifests the national security consensus I was trying to describe for you. Yes, ma'am.
Well, and now it seems like there's some serious talk about Iran, you know, that either Israel is planning an attack or we're, you know, going to plan an attack. But, you know, there continues to be rumblings about that. And I'm thinking, my God, that would be something that we would all say, wait a minute, whoa, wait a minute. But I'm not sure that would happen. And how serious are those, you know? I mean, I can't imagine us being in, you know, getting into that whole mess doing that. But how serious?
We're going to get you a job as a planner in the J5 division of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because you can see clearly what a foolish act that would be. And I would have to say, and maybe I'm the naive one here, to my mind, it is so patently obvious that a U.S. attack on Iran is just a dumb idea. I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't think it's going to happen in part because we have our hands full, to put it mildly. Those expectations that existed a decade ago about an American military that is unstoppable and can deliver quickly and efficiently victory have pretty much been, I think, undermined by events. And I think probably nobody is more conscious of the fact that we've got our military plate full than military leaders who don't need yet another war. And indeed, were there to be another war in Iran, almost certainly events in Afghanistan and in Iraq would be adversely affected. So were I a betting man, which I am not, I would bet the United States is not going to attack Iran anytime soon. I also happen to believe that even if the Iranians got a bomb, we could deter them. That faced with the realization that their use of a weapon would result in truly the total destruction of their society, that would probably serve to cause them to exercise self-restraint. Now, I was speaking to you as an American. Were I to address this issue as an Israeli Jew, I might have a different view. I don't believe Iran poses, not only does Iran not pose an existential threat to the United States, I don't think it poses any significant threat to the United States. But were I an Israeli Jew, and therefore conscious of the history of Judaism, and conscious of the history of Israel, I might not be quite so quick to say, oh, no existential threat. Oh, yes, they can be deterred. And I say that because I do think that perhaps within, and I'm speculating, I have no direct knowledge, that within governing circles in Israel, the assessment and the calculus might be a different one. It doesn't follow that tomorrow morning the Israelis are going to pull the trigger. I mean, it's a tough operational problem to locate. If there is an Iranian nuclear weapons program, we're not even sure of that, but if there is one, to locate all its components and then to be able to destroy it would be a challenging task, even for us. And then there's the fact that the part of the Israeli calculus has to be what would be the effect of their attacking Iran on U.S.-Israeli relations. Clearly, they assigned tremendous value to the fact of their strategic relationship with us, which gets increased, I think, as Israel's standing in the rest of the world continues to decline. You know, whether that view of Israel is fair or not, it seems to me pretty clear that there is a certain amount of isolation of Israel occurring. And that makes us all the more important to them. And they would have to take into account, if they attack, what's that do to the U.S.? If attacking Iran ends up rupturing the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and it could be the price they pay to take out the Iranian threat wouldn't be worth it. But I don't pretend to know how that would play out. Yes, sir.
How would you go about conventioning the military-industrial emphasize the industrial part of that equation. The younger students of DU and other liberals, bankruptcy of policy in Afghanistan, military bankruptcy of the policy in Afghanistan that is being so ably exposed by Robert Greenwald in his series Rethinking Afghanistan,
when the economic objectives are, as Seymour Bellman pointed out years ago, the permanent war economy, cost plus, base military bases, the military being the largest employment program, a very large consumer of energy, how do you expose the fact that our tax money is going to pay the Taliban, right? They were paying $13 million for each drone aircraft that's killing Afghanistan civilians.
You've asked at least three questions, I think four, but I'm not sure.
How do you expose the economic bankruptcy, not just the moral bankruptcy, when people are still, you know, nervous about building a mosque at Ground Zero?
That's the fifth question. That's the fifth question.
How do you expose the economic bankruptcy?
Okay, I'm going to ignore the other four. Okay. So the question is...
One more thing.
Oh, my God. If you don't buy a book, I'm really going to be mad. Okay. Your question, sir?
How do you expose the fact, as General Smedley Butler said in 1930...
The war is a racket.
The war is a racket.
Okay. But all of that, I think, really, if I may, reduces to a question that I would phrase this way. To the extent that the American economy is beholden to the sorts of policies I described, then what's the likelihood we're going to change our policies? Since by the assumption would be, the implication would be that the economic price we would pay for changing national security policies would be very high. Well, this is what I would say. Ike was right. There is a military-industrial complex, and you can bet your bippy, as they used to say on TV, that the president of, I lose track after all the mergers, but the president of Lockheed Martin or Raytheon is probably more likely to get his phone call answered in the White House than I am. I mean, these people have leverage, they have influence, they are skilled at employing it, and as I suggested in my remarks, to the extent that Washington is committed to the Washington rules, the military-industrial complex is one explanation. But I was trying to emphasize it's not the only explanation. I think that I have sensed in some of the presentations that I have given, I'm not trying to lay this on you, I've sensed an inclination on the part of some people to say, damn it, if we get, I was being recorded, darn it, if we could just get rid of this military-industrial complex, everything else would be okay. That is a sufficient explanation in itself for policies that may from time to time be misguided. I think that overlooks a lot of other factors. I would point out that even though the amount we're currently spending on quote-unquote defense is greater in constant dollars than at any time during the Cold War, which is a phenomenal reality, military spending as a proportion of the overall economy is now far smaller than what it once was. Some of my friends from the University of Denver will have better data than I will, but I think that on average, across the Cold War, on average, defense spending was about 10% of GDP. Higher during Korea, you know, lower during the Jimmy Carter years. But on average, from 1950, when the Korean War began, until 1989 or so, about 10% of the economy is going to defense. Right now, it's about 4.2%. That's not a trivial amount, but what it really says is, to the extent that our prosperity is dependent upon military spending, it's actually not as dependent as it once was. And that's one of the reasons why I think we shouldn't lay the problem simply at the doorstep of the military-industrial complex. Now, please, if you think you just heard me say, I don't think the military-industrial complex matters, I don't think it's an issue, I don't think it's a concern, that's not what I was trying to say. I think this is probably the last one.
One comment about hope. There was a huge movement here against the Iraq War. And my own view, having been part of it, that was so important, is that the Iraq War.
I'll repeat it, don't worry.
Never a popular war. And I think it's important to distinguish between the interests of most of us and however you characterize this elite. And just as a footnote, speaking as a Jew, I think that most Jews in Israel are very badly served by the Israeli government and its exercise of creating great Israel. The question I have is really following on what you said. Petraeus is lobbying to keep us in Afghanistan. And it would seem like the logic of the war complex, the military-industrial complex, is to get its way through the president. To what extent is the foolishness of this, in fact, that we broke, likely to be some sort of...
The foolishness
of this, keep staying on in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're utterly broke and that many others are here. Is this possibly going to be enough so that Obama might, after all, he was an anti-war candidate once upon a time?
So is it possible that the folly of Afghanistan will persuade President Obama to, I think your question is not simply get out of Afghanistan, but perhaps confront the national security consensus and continue or consider a different path? And my answer is no. And the reason I think it's no is a couple reasons. I think the most important reason is he already blew his chance. I think, you know, the president, whom I voted for, supported, and would like to see succeed, I mean, remember the excitement in the country the day he was inaugurated. I mean, if the president had said, tomorrow morning, I want every American out of bed at 6, and we're all going to do jumping jacks and go run around the track. Apart from, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Dick Cheney, we all would have been out there. Because the man's moral authority at that moment in the early days of his presidency was through the roof. And I think at that moment, he might have been able to mount an assault on the national security consensus with some chance of success. He didn't act immediately. Instead, he, whether consciously or through circumstance, I think, allowed attention to be focused on a very specific national security question. And the national security question was, what are we going to do about Afghanistan? And he anguished, and he studied, and he analyzed, and he found himself boxed into a corner when the McChrystal strategy was leaked to the Washington Post. And ultimately, what he decided to do is exactly what John McCain would have done had we elected John McCain. He chose to prolong and to escalate the war, and I think that at that moment, he forfeited any real chance to make big change in the realm of national security, because Afghanistan became Obama's war. And since then, the president's own standing and leverage and influence, to my mind, has decreased precipitously, and the advocates of the status quo are still there advocating the status quo.
And you predicted that.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do think that he squandered a great opportunity, and now he and we are left to deal with the consequences. Thanks very much for this chance to talk to you. I really enjoyed it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.